And if you've not already done so, please remember to sign in. There's some sign-in sheets.
Yes, sir.
Good, thank you. Yes, sir. Yeah, we can take the time to do that right now. Thank you.
Shall I approach the lectern now?
Sure. Okay. We're ready for you, sir.
Thank you. My name is Norman Lampson. I'm counsel for the daughter of Patricia Gerald, Tarsha Gerald. I'll try to refer to as Tarsha so we don't get him confused.
Right. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Thank you, Judge. 3 minutes.
3 minutes, yes, sir.
We're kind of like representing co-defendants, but my tack is a little different from Mr. Hallahan. We didn't actually work together on this case. I've got three issues: sufficiency of the evidence on perjury, venue on perjury, and sufficiency of the evidence on the suspended operator's license charge. On the perjury, on sufficiency of the evidence, of course, perjury is a false statement under oath made willfully that is material to competent proceedings. And the Commonwealth had three theories: a falsity in saying she wasn't driving, a falsity in saying she did not make an admission to Officer Miller she was driving, and falsity in denying she didn't make the statement to Officer Scopoletti on the phone that she was driving. The Commonwealth tries to use the latter as corroboration also to support the principal contention that there was perjury in saying she wasn't driving. That is, they use those as out-of-court admissions. You've got Tarsha's word against Welsh's word, and they're saying, well, she made these out-of-court admissions, so that strengthens the claim that she was driving. Now, the rule in perjury is that when the proceeding is in question and answer format, you have to prove precisely the question to which the statement given is the answer.
What Virginia case stands for that proposition?
I couldn't find any Virginia authority, Judge. I couldn't find where it's been raised in any court. It's not against me. It's not for me. It just hasn't been discussed. I rely on federal courts and state courts.
Okay, well, so there's no case binding on us. Explain to us why it's not simply enough to demonstrate that false testimony was in fact given. Why does it have to be the precise question, and if I understand your precise question argument, it applies to the question that the officer asked her before she confessed out of court.
I wouldn't call it a confession, because a confession is admission of all elements. And that's part of my point. The officer just said out of court, I wasn't driving. She didn't say out of court, I wasn't driving after the collision, and I drove eastbound in the vicinity of Ivy, 250 West on this date at this time. She didn't make that statement.
Well, right, but the only... to the extent she acknowledged driving to the officer after the accident, I mean, in the context of the questions about the accident, that's the only element that's at play here. There's no dispute that she did not have an operator's license.
Right.
I mean, how is that not a confession that she committed the offense if it's undisputed that she didn't have a valid operator's license?
Well, again, what is I wasn't driving? I wasn't driving in Colesville on a different date.
Well, she didn't say I wasn't driving. She said she was driving.
I mean, she said, okay, I was driving in Colesville on a different date. How is that a confession to this charge? I think you're trying to look at the evidence in this case, and you're kind of assuming the questions and answers were similar in the general district court, but you can't make that assumption. The Commonwealth's got to prove it. And they had only one witness, Scopoletti. He wasn't sworn to truthfully transcribe the proceedings in the general district court. He's going on his memory. He claims that she said she wasn't driving. But he doesn't really have memory of what the questions were. If I recall, I don't think he could remember who testified first, whether it's Patricia or Tarsha.
But isn't that a question for the trier of fact?
No. What the questions were, whether they proved the question, you can look at the transcript. You just look and ask the Commonwealth, pin them out. Where are the questions? You just look at the transcript. If they don't have the questions, then reasonable minds couldn't differ that they didn't prove the questions. And so you can't evaluate falsity, because you have to evaluate falsity in the context of the question. And you have to evaluate willfulness in the context of the question. I think that it's obvious the reason behind the rule. You can't know whether the statement is false unless you know the question, and you can't know whether the statement was willfully made if you don't know the question. So whether there's a Virginia case on point, I don't think is really significant. The common law is the rule of reason, right? That's the English law adopted in Virginia, Lord Cook, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think you have a problem with that. Now, of course, if there is evidence that Tarsha said, again, I was not driving after the wreck with Paul Welch, easterly 250 West, and the Ivy Air, et cetera, et cetera, then what the question is might not be that important. But that's not this case. So, again, my attack on sufficiency of evidence is focusing on that aspect of it. The court can't determine what the question was. I mean, the trial court couldn't determine what the question was, and hence cannot determine if it was ambiguous, and whether it was arguably ambiguous or whether it was fatally ambiguous. So I don't think there's perjury in the statement, I wasn't driving. I don't think there's perjury in the statement, I was driving, these out-of-court statements to the various officers. So I don't think there's sufficient evidence, and I think the court erred in overruling the motion to strike. Now, turning to my venue question, my position is, of course, venue is in the city, not in the county. I rely on 19.2-244, which says that except as otherwise provided, venue shall be in the locality where the offense occurs. On brief, the Commonwealth's sole position is that Section 48 is an, quote, except as otherwise provided provision. And so that frames the issue here between us. As a rule of statutory construction, for a proviso to meet the proviso, it has to relate to the principal matter of the statute in question. So Section 48 of the city charter would have to relate to venue, because venue is the principal matter of 19.2-244. It doesn't use the word venue. It doesn't have the language of Garza. It doesn't say that with respect to the land belonging to the county in the city, as to offenses against the laws of the Commonwealth occurring on that land, there shall be concurrent jurisdiction with the county circuit court and district court.
But it does say that the officers of Albemarle County will have jurisdiction over, essentially, for our purposes, the courthouse. And wouldn't officers necessarily include law enforcement officers? And judicial officers?
Well, but of course, as far as the police officer, I mean, the officer isn't arresting her for, the county officer would be a county officer, that's true. But as far as the judicial officer, that would not be a county or city officer, nor would the prosecuting attorney be a county or city officer. The Commonwealth is trying to say an authority.
A Commonwealth's attorney is a constitutional officer of the locality that elects them. How would the Commonwealth's attorney of Albemarle County not be an Albemarle County officer?
Because he's a state officer.
It is very clear, Dowd versus the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth cannot hire, fire, or do anything with a constitutional officer because he is an officer of the locality. Well, he's elected by the voters, but he is not an employee agent of the Commonwealth in the traditional employment sense.
Well, if he is a county officer, I mean, well, if I'm wrong on that, I still say you've got a problem with the judge. The judge is a state officer. I mean, how are you going to do that with the judge? The statewide General Assembly appointed Judge Higgins to sit in the 16th Judicial Circuit. She is no more a county officer than you are county officers. The same entity that appointed you appointed her. So she is not a county or city officer. She is a state officer. And the Commonwealth is saying they can use this provision to bring a proceeding in a state court that the General Assembly creates. They create the statute. They create the court, and it's not some joint municipal court. It's not like the county and city have made a joint ordinance. There is hereby created the Albemarle-Charlottesville Joint Municipal Court, and there is hereby an officer who is the prosecutor of this court. There is a judge who will sit in this court. Under Dillon's rule, it would be an authority for city and county authorities to make these ordinances. Their provision is they can bring a state court proceeding, tried in state court before a state officer, a state judicial officer.
So if you've got a contempt of court that occurs in that courthouse that's not direct contempt, meaning that it requires due process, are you telling me that would have to be prosecuted in a different courthouse?
I think it would be, Judge, if it's not a direct contempt. I think that they could use direct contempt because... Because if it's right in front of the judge can act. The judge has inherent authority to protect himself or herself as to direct contempt. But if it's an indirect, I think the same principle would apply.
Wait, in direct contempt cases, is venue an element?
No, I don't think so. I think that's in itself an exception to venue. I think it's an exception to venue. I think whenever a contempt is in front of the court, the court has power to act to protect itself. So it's like a kind of a self-supplying venue provision. So now, if you ask me, what do I think the words mean? Okay, it's not venue. I think the best thing, and looking at this murky word, you plumb murky depths. I think the general idea was that the state wanted the city to be respectful of the county. They owned the land before the city came into existence. Looking at the words possession and use, I think they wanted the county and the city to work together, try to come up with joint ordinances relating to possession and use of the property. If you can't agree, give it to the arbitrators.
Well, then the question becomes, if they have joint jurisdiction and don't, and to the best of my knowledge, they haven't sat as both the city council and the board of supervisors passing legislation. I mean, how would it not be lawless? If your theory is correct.
Well, I mean, they can make rules together relating to use and possession if they want to. I don't think they viewed a victim as being naked.
What is the procedure for either a city or a county ordinance to be passed by both bodies? To me, that's completely unknown.
I don't know. I mean, you know, why can't the Alamo County get together and say, we'll adopt this, the Board of Supervisors adopt this, the City Council get together and they look at what the county adopts and say, do you all vote for it? They vote for it. So you've got joint rules. Each has joint rules pertaining to possession and use.
But if they don't both agree, there's no law that covers this particular piece of property.
There's the criminal law. Again, I mean, I don't think
the state criminal law, but no local ordinances.
City ordinances would apply to any crime in the city.
Why? It says joint jurisdiction, and according to you, that means they both have to do it together.
I think it's use and possession. I'm looking at the provision in its totality, looking at the entire word, and the next section talks about arbitration. We know from Section 3 they knew how to exclude the University of Virginia, the old part of the University of Virginia, and say that's not part of the city. Think I have 1 minute. On the sufficiency of the evidence for grabbing on a suspended, the rule is that the credibility of the witnesses is for the trial court. Judge Higgins said the Commonwealth's witnesses were more credible, so that makes it a difficult situation for the defendant. My client earnestly believes that she was not driving, that she's not guilty of perjury. My only argument can be that the testimony of the Commonwealth was inherently incredible, and ask the court to reverse and dismiss that proceeding as well. So I ask the court to reverse and dismiss, or else reverse and remand on perjury for venue.
Thank you, Mr. Lamson. Mr. Chandler?
Morning again, and may it please the court. Christian with the Commonwealth. The question of the sufficiency of the evidence to prove perjury and whether or not the Commonwealth was required to prove the exact questions that were posed in the General District Court. Of course, as the court has already pointed out, no Virginia case has ever held that there is such a rule. If there were, that would almost require the Commonwealth to have a court reporter in every General District Court hearing, because in most cases, perjury cannot be anticipated. So that rule would certainly, the Commonwealth would contend, go much too far. What Mr. Lamson has essentially proposed is a hypothesis of innocence, that perhaps in General District Court, the questions that were asked of his client were questions about whether or not she'd been driving on some other day, at some other time, in some other place. So I would submit that this court should treat that hypothesis as this court treats any hypothesis of innocence. And the question is whether or not the Commonwealth, the evidence that the Commonwealth put forward was sufficient for a reasonable fact finder to reject that hypothesis of innocence. In this particular case, there's no reason to think that Ms. Gerald was being asked about whether or not she drove at some other time, at some other location, on some other date, because based on the summons that brought her into court for General District Court, she was being charged with driving on a suspended license at a certain time, at a certain place, on a certain date. And for that reason, a fact finder could have reasonably rejected the theory that she'd been asked about something else, could have concluded that she did indeed deny driving on the date and time in question, and that for that reason she was guilty of perjury. On the venue question, which we've discussed previously, I do just want to make a couple of additional points. 19.2-250 does not use the word venue, and that statute talks about jurisdiction extending within 1 mile of abutting other jurisdictions and localities. Does not use the word venue. Opposing counsel contends that that's a major sticking point with the Act of the Assembly at issue here, but it's not. Joint jurisdiction means territorial jurisdiction, which also means venue, as this court has held multiple times. 19.2-250 also uses the phrase corporate authorities. Doesn't say locally elected authorities. It simply says corporate authorities, which is analogous to what the Act of the Assembly says here, which is that it says county and city authorities and officers. And in Kirby, this court held in examining 19.2-250 that grant of jurisdiction to county to corporate authorities does extend territorial jurisdiction, extends venue, and basically gives the county, if I think it was Chesterfield in that particular case, joint jurisdiction within 1 mile of the city limits of Richmond. The same is true in this particular case with very similar language in the Act of the Assembly that is at issue. So for those reasons and based on this court's prior case law, the venue was proper in Albemarle. And this distinction between authorities and officers is really beside the point because the Act of the Assembly said county and city authorities, and then as it was subsequently readopted, the word officers was added in. So authorities and officers, and the judge, the court, the prosecutor certainly constitute county authorities and officers in this particular case. And then finally, on the sufficiency of the evidence after the suspended license, the credibility of the witnesses is for the trial court. We ask the court to defer to those resolutions. Unless there are any questions for the Commonwealth, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lampson, your remaining time.
Thank you.
Judge, the Commonwealth contends that that under my hypothesis, they'd have to have a transcript of every time, of the general district court proceedings to use that in the circuit court. That's not exactly correct. I mean, you could have, the Commonwealth attorney could recuse herself, then thereby enabling herself to be a witness. You could call the defense attorneys who recused themselves from the case. And there are lots of ways you could have other witnesses testify to what was said in the general district court.
But isn't that much like what went on here then with the officer who was in attendance and took notes and testified as to what was done and said in the general district court?
Yeah, but it was just one person who's going on his memory again he can remember pretty much, or he can claim to remember what was said, but really not the questions that were propounded to these witnesses, Judge. The Commonwealth says that there's no reason that Ms. Tarsha Gerald would assume the questions related to some other date or place based on the summons. Of course, that would not apply to her out-of-court statements. The effort to utilize her out-of-court statements at the time she made those, there was no summons issued. With respect to the statement made after the summons was issued, again, I think there's an assumption that just because there's a summons and you have proceedings here that show what questions and answers were in this proceeding, that somehow the questions and answers in the general district court were similar to that. And I don't think you can just guess that's the case. Relating to the citation to 19.2-250, in the Commonwealth's reference to that. Of course, that case that they cited treats the provision as one of territorial jurisdiction. They're talking about extending beyond the corporate limits. And territorial jurisdiction is basically the same as venue. And so I think that, again, that language is distinguishable from here. It's just not the same. So I believe that the evidence here is insufficient on both both the charges, and in the alternative, I ask the court to reverse and remand on venue.
All right. Thank you very much. This case is submitted and keeping.